coming to you deep from the center of a Canadian man's sinus cavity. It's the Punk News Podcast, episode 470. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name's Adam White.
Oh, that was so great, Adam. You sound just like Joe Keithley there for a minute.
Don't
you clear your throat sound? I love it.
That's the secret to Joe is he's always ill. Just like how Hulk is always mad. Well, Joe is just always with head cold.
Well, I mean, he's always
Joey Keithley, surprisingly tall. Very tall man.
He is. He's a tall drink of water.
He is a tall man, but he looks in his age almost identical to like a pastiche of all of my friends' fathers when I was in high school. And I saw him play.
He's got to be pushing 60, right? At least mid 50s.
Oh yeah, he's on, right? He's on
an age.
I mean, I don't want to say Joe Keithley looks bad or anything. He looks just like a man of his age, right? But he's a man of his age that's usually wearing like a sleeveless DOA t-shirt.
Looks like he could still play hockey.
And just I see him and I'm like, you look like someone's dad to me, and it's very confusing, very off-putting. So yeah,
he's like the Canadian Tesco V. He's another giant. John, have you ever stood next to Tesco V?
Tesco V, well, he calls himself the Dutch Hercules. Like, he really is a huge person.
I saw him again at a show. Oh, it was Guar last time Guar played Grand Rapids again. I saw him, but I just couldn't bother him. I just didn't have the heart to bother him.
Oh, he's cool. You should say, are you going to his flea market?
I am going. So we're doing our anniversary trip a little late, and we're coming home that day on a Sunday. It's on a Sunday, and I forgot all about it. I was so excited. I was going to make my kid with his permit drive me over there for like hours of practice, but I think I'm going to miss it. But they do one in Lansing that's actually a little closer, so I'll get to one eventually.
So anyways, this is the Punk News Podcast.
This is the Tesco V Toy Swap Meet Podcast.
You're listening to Mr. Tom Trauma out of Michigan. That was Mr. John Gentile out of Philly. I'm Adam White. I'm dying north of the border here. So it is
drowning.
The season.
He's drowning in snot.
Drowning in snot. I don't know. It's not even that. It's like it's some sort of like thing in my chest. Like, children are gross. You shouldn't have children.
Isn't it wonderful having children in grade school? Or whatever you have your children. And daycare, wherever they are.
The worst thing is that I have these illusions that I am somehow a healthier superhuman, whereby both kids get sick and my wife gets sick, and I just kind of like power through it and laugh at them, and then just as they all start to recover, I get the thing. It's like I can maybe fight it off for another few days than the rest of them, but I am by no means immune. So yeah, I'm just you know.
Let me tell you my astounding immunity story, if you will. So I was in Egypt in 2005, and they said, "Don't drink the water. Don't drink the water. You're going to get sick, but really don't drink the water because you'll get super sick." And sure enough, when we're there, everyone's getting sick, and you basically have the craps for about a day or so, right? And I didn't get them. Like, oh man, I'm next.
Just a day or so? That doesn't seem that bad.
You're pretty messed up for like a day, but then
you're Pharaoh's Revenge, they call that?
They do call it that. And I'm like, and I'm like, oh man, it's like, ah, it's gonna be bad, it's gonna be bad. So I'm out there on the dig site, and one of the Egyptians says, yeah, here's some water. And I didn't even think, I just drank it, I didn't even think about it, you know what I mean? And I gave it back to him, and you know, the day goes by, and then I go back to the dig house, and I'm like, oh shit, I straight up drank like water from Egypt, you know? I'm like, oh my god, I'm gonna have problems. And I never got sick, and so the next day I just started drinking Egyptian water. I never had any problems.
Oh wait, so you avoided the problem, and then you just leaned into it, assumed that you were some, like, you didn't just chance out of it. You didn't Russian roulette the bad Egyptian water. You then just started guzzling it by the bucket.
Well, I figured because I didn't worry about it, like my body, like, was it like I didn't worry about it, so the antibodies in my body weren't like on edge. They were like just chilled, like, oh, here comes the germ, let's beat them up. And so I'm like, well, listen, man, if they're confident, I'm confident. You know what I mean? And that's what happened.
I work in a job where I'm exposed to a lot of pathogens, and I never get sick either, and a lot of the other guys do. But I think the key is just to accidentally consume little bits of it. It's like I'm self-immunizing.
I mean, that's true, though, I think. I think
it does work. So, I mean, I take certain precautions. I always cover my mouth when I'm in a real nasty environment. But I mean, like with a mask, like the Asian people wear in the subways. But I seem to have a pretty good system too. Our whole family, we're pretty good like that. We don't get it a lot. I mean, we get a little sniffle here and there, but we don't.
I just make sure that all the liquids that I drink when I'm abroad are alcoholic, and then
exactly, it's not a problem. You know, that's what they say when you're in Mexico, right? Drink the beer.
So, anyways, I don't know. I don't know what's going on tonight. There's stories. John made a list of stories. He painstakingly put together a bunch of interesting topics. I didn't read them.
They're painful. I'll give him that.
I'm flying blind. I don't know what I'm even doing here. This is, you know, unsubscribe now and make more space on your iPhone for.
Stay subscribed, listeners. We've got an excellent episode, especially just for you.
No, I'm just, this is fatalistic. This is rudimentary peni, Adam, right now. Just like, you know, delete the podcast. You know. Drive your car into a ditch, burn down your house. Fuck it.
You know from the survey, John, that Adam has no influence, so we don't have to worry about him having a negative effect on things.
It's funny that Adam brings up the nihilism of rudimentary peni, because I was literally thinking in depth about rudimentary peni about four hours ago.
That's one of your like default modes, though. Like you're probably that is like six times a day. For you.
That's true.
That is, but that's strange. I mean, but you gotta admit, Adam, he's a deep diver, you know. Most of us never get past crass. He's all the way to rudimentary peni.
All right. So what are we doing right now? Because I mean, I'm really tempted just to like to hit the mute button on my mic and lay down on my laptop for the next hour and a half.
Let's do some mail and we'll see if Adam gets through it or not. You can always use that podcast at punknews.org. We've got two pretty interesting letters this week, which whenever there's a break in the feed, we usually kind of get these unusual type letters. So here's what we got. This is from Delia M. You cover a lot of neat music and shows, but you rarely talk about social justice issues like fundraisers and important causes. Why don't you address more issues like harm reduction, sex workers' rights, and have some guests on from social causes? Don't you think that's punk? From Delia M.
Seems like it's what's become punk. Or what goes as punk these days, but we try to avoid politics at pretty much every turn, I would say, don't we?
No, I disagree. I think we take politics head on sometimes. Now, I mean, see, honestly, like during the Trump election, we actually kind of became like the politics cast. But then I said, well, maybe we should pull back because although politics is an important part of punk, it's not the only part of punk.
But the problem, and right now everything's such a circus. I mean, we literally have this impeachment hearing going on and I'm 99% tuned out on it. I mean, I'll catch little bits of it here and there, but I'm just, it's like we're so jaded about the whole everything. At least I am.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been voting for a long time, kids. My first national election I voted was in 1992. Let me tell you something. We ain't voting our way out of our problems.
So to swing back to the question, though, that actually it plays into something that I was thinking about earlier today when.
Rudimentary peni?
Rudimentary peni. No, I was sitting there looking at my Twitter feed and scrolling around and going like, I'm like, I'm not even sure how to engage in anything right now. And partly it's that at a certain point a little while ago, I decided that, you know what, I need to expose myself to more viewpoints from people that aren't just like straight up in my lane, kind of like, you know, middle-aged white cis guys talking about music. So there's a good number of people that I think they're all like tangentially music related, but who I follow now that are that come from different walks, right? You know, people of color, you know, trans folks, indigenous people, and just like looking at the kind of things that they're on there posting about and talking about and having conversations about. And these are all people that have to deal with like actual real stuff, right? That is not that I don't have to deal with because I won the the roll of the dice lottery and you know happened to be part of the big boring, you know, ruling middle, I guess, right? So, but I see all these people and they're on there and they're fighting all the time. Like they have causes that are righteous and important and all this kind of stuff. And I get on and I'll look in the morning and I'll see everyone's on there, you know, grinding their axe, right? But like rightfully grinding their axe because they have real stuff that they're talking about. And I look at it and I go, oh, I was gonna pop onto Twitter and just like, you know, post some stupid quip about, you know, coffee and bad religion or something, right? Like I was gonna go do my kind of normal, boring, stupid shit. But I find that like I'll go on and I'll look and I'll see all these people having actual issues, and I just don't, because I don't really know what I'm supposed to do. Like I don't want to be there ignoring all of these actual things that are happening that are important and just be like quipping along like a dummy on the sidelines. But then I see people that are from my that I think are in my situation that are trying to take it to take the bull by the horns, and what they do is they sit around all day and just like retweet people's causes and stuff like that. They're not really adding anything to it except that they're retweeting these things and just being like, yeah, or like that that's the extent to which they're like, that's the extent.
Like an activism, right? Slacktivism.
Yeah, like there's that element to it, and there's I don't know if that's effective either, right? And I mean, and there's musicians that even do it too, and some of them, I'm not sure how I'm supposed to take their interaction with it, and I'm not sure if they're aware of what they're trying to accomplish, right? So to take someone, say that's like that's, you know, here, I'm not calling anyone out here because they're a super public person and I love them, right? But you take someone like, say, AC Newman, who's the singer for the New Pornographers. So he's a super political guy. He is constantly throughout the day, you know, sharing this, that, and whatever that's happened, you know, with the Trump administration and with the impeachment inquiry and all this kind of stuff, right? And it's like, so I'm seeing all of it popping through onto my feed because he's retweeting it or anything like that. But he's not adding anything substantial to it. He's amplifying people that are talking about it, which I guess is useful to a degree. But on the other hand, I'm looking at it going like, well, like if I wanted to go get U.S. politics feed, I could go subscribe to U.S. politics feed somewhere. I don't need you, AC, to be providing me with that. But on the other hand, that's kind of a selfish thing. Like, why would I want to go to this person and say, hey, you're really involved and concerned about what's going on in the world. Please stop that and talk about your third record, because I don't think enough people talk about that, right? Like, I don't want to say that to them, but so I just end up sort of paralyzed. Or I'm like, well, what do I do now? Like, how do I interact with anything? And I think it comes like the one way that I figure out about how to do it or how to navigate with it or navigate through that stuff is just to go realize that like my job in the universe, in the grand arc of history, my job is probably to not take up a whole ton of space and let other people talk. And I feel like on a lot of these issues, that's maybe where I'm best served, or like that's maybe where I'm most useful. So if it's something like, I don't know, let's say they take one of the examples from the writer here about, you know, something like sex workers' rights or something like that, right? Where like, on the one hand, like I'm totally on board with that as a cause. On the other hand, I have nothing to say there from the state. Like I have nothing. I don't want to, it's not a conversation that I want to purport to have any good knowledge of. It's not something I want to step out in front of and like make about me. It's really one of these things where like, yeah, you know, there are people who are having important conversations about that, who are from that world, or who regularly on their day to day, you know, interact with people from that world, and they should get the space. I shouldn't try to like take that. And I look at a lot of these politics issues and I go, or these social justice issues, and I say like, yeah, like my job here is probably to shut up and sit down and listen, and not to try to take all issues in and filter them out through myself. So I don't know, that's how a lot of that stuff feels, I guess, when it comes to this show, where I look at it and go like, you know what? So much of that stuff is important and is punk rock, but it's like, but the people that are out there talking about that stuff and that have like real, you know, useful knowledge and commentary and whatever on it, they should be getting the space to talk about that. It shouldn't be me trying to give my like half-assed, poorly researched version thereof. And I don't know. I mean, in a way, it's kind of a cop-out because I'm saying that like, you know, yeah, that's important, but I'm not going to do anything about it. But on the other hand, that's probably what's going to happen, is we will acknowledge that it's important and we won't do too much about it. And I don't exactly know what the answer is. I'm not coming to a conclusion here, but that's how I just feel interacting with the internet these days. Is I go and I look and I'm like, oh God, everyone's mad, and everyone seems to be mad with reason. And you know, here I am. I'm gonna Instagram a picture of my kids. Like it just it feels like the important shit is happening, and I shouldn't try to get in front of it.
You know, I don't think that's the worst thing in the world, Adam, because I think it's, you see so many people, especially white middle class liberal types, who seem like they want to kind of appropriate every cause, and I think you're better off to sort of avoid it than you are to come across as an insincere sort of wagon hopper or something, you know.
Well, you know what it is.
I disagree with both of you. I disagree with both of you entirely. I gotta say, a big part of, I guess, breaking away from religious control is concept of original sin, that you are guilty or that you are responsible for something just because you were born. I don't agree with any of that. I don't agree with certain, I guess, narratives right now.
I don't know
now.
Which one of us said that, Adam, but he's disagreeing with us.
I'm disagreeing with both of you. But the point,
our big original sin agreement, Adam.
I think that we could do a better job, you know, with the maximum rock and roll type stuff, if you will. And I wish that the podcast and the site would improve that. And I guess I'll take steps to improve that to a degree if I can. So there. Hey.
All right.
Typical middle class white liberal trying to take ownership of something that doesn't belong.
Well, see, here, this plays into something I've been thinking about a lot, which is, and this is creepy. This is paradoxically kind of about Star Wars.
Oh God.
But it's very lightly about Star Wars. I have not seen or consumed any of the recent Star Wars things that people are talking about on the internet. It doesn't really have anything to do with that. But it comes back to what I was saying earlier, where I see all these people, you know, from different experiences that have all these like very real issues and stuff like that. And I go like, well, what am I supposed to do with regards to any of that information? And I feel that like the younger Adam, like the 20-something-year-old Adam, would have like engaged deeply. Or sorry, I would have purported to have engaged deeply with those issues. Like I would have told myself I was engaging deeply in it, but what I was probably doing was, you know, interacting with it until it became inconvenient for me to do so, and then just sort of like living my comfortable life otherwise. Whereas now I'm sort of looking at it and going like, and saying like, I don't know how I'm supposed to engage with this, but it probably shouldn't be to make it about me. And so the Star Wars comes into this is that I kind of feel like as a, as a middle class white person, I feel like I'm a stormtrooper. And like, but like a stormtrooper after the Empire fell.
I can't put that at all, Adam. I really can't.
John disagrees. He's Boba
Fett. I'm looking on the world and going like, you know what? There was a time when my lot was to kind of like to march around and make everything about me. But at the moment, there's all these rebels running around doing good stuff and everything. And I should totally be like with them and sympathetic with them and, you know, engaging in their new republic. But engaging in their new republic probably doesn't mean I step up ahead of it and be like, hey, everyone, it's me, the stormtrooper. Let's, you know, give me the authority on this. And I was like, no, I should probably figure out how to like humbly live my life and listen to what all the the Admiral Akbars of the world are trying to tell me and not be. You know, not be marching around in my white helmet.
Well, I wasn't planning on taking this conversation this direction, and would I can solve this problem here tonight. But I cannot agree with the concept at all that if you're white, then you don't deserve to have a voice, or if you're white, you've done something bad, or if you're white, you by being white have advantage over everybody else. That certainly has not been my experience, and it's been the opposite, honestly. And it certainly has not been my father's experience. So I really do take a very big insult to that. Well, not I don't know if insult is the right word, but I really disagree with that foundational claim, which a lot of people have. I think it's entirely misfounded.
John, you're going to get kicked out of Punk.
Well, I feel as though it's an entirely misfounded thing, and I believe it destroys any sense of nuance whatsoever, and I believe it's extremely racist. And that being said, just because I'm saying – that I don't believe in that agreement doesn't mean other people haven't had hardships and had a struggle as well. They certainly have. But I cannot get on board with the idea that just because you're white, it means that you were born a life of privilege. Just because you're white, you've done a bad thing. Or just because white, you are somehow negatively affecting other people just because you're white. I mean, that's the definition of racism. And I can't get behind that at all. So, I mean.
100% agree with you, John, but that's a very unpopular opinion. Will say that the only reason we can feel like that is because we're privileged to begin with.
I mean, I can get into some specifics, but I'm not going to. Adam, I'll let you have the final word on that. I don't want to make this a big debate about that, but go ahead.
No, you're taking it from a little bit of a harsher place than I'm coming at it. What I was more getting at was that like, and this is why I was specifically bringing this into like the Star Wars analogy there was that like, because like the stormtrooper is like, I like him in this example because he is not, like, he didn't create all that Empire shit, right? He probably had nothing to do with it. He was born into it, right? He was just, you know.
Well, going off episode 1, 2, and 3 or 4, 5, and 6, because it's entirely, you know, it's different. You know?
I have no mental recollection of 1, 2, and 3, so I'm going to pretend that doesn't happen. I'm just talking about you were just a nameless dude in a white bucket helmet walking around doing your thing. You're not the Empire. You're not the guy in the. You're not Grand Moff Tarkin, right? You're just some schmuck, right? But you're some schmuck that, you know, that was on the up end of schmuck. I'm just saying that after the shit hits the fan, after the Emperor gets thrown down the lightning tube there, the urge is always to make the narrative about you. It's like it's that thing where like everyone is like the protagonist in their own story kind of thing. Right, like the urge is to make the narrative.
Well, actually, Adam, everyone is the protagonist in their own story because I mean, like, you know, if you're not, you know, thinking of yourself as a full person, what are you doing? You know what I mean?
Well, sure, but I mean that you to a degree you are, but not every story, I guess, has to be like the hero's journey, right? So if you were the guy that was, you know, you were a stormtrooper when the Empire was around, and now the Empire has fallen, and there's some other voices that are coming in there. What's your role? Like maybe it is not to be the hero of this new story. Maybe it's to like, maybe you should go be a farmer. Like, you know, maybe you should go, you know, you should become the guy that works in the fucking cantina or something like that. There's a way forward in this stuff, which is not to like assert yourself as being at the center of it, I guess is what I'm trying to come at. So when I see a lot of people doing this, so let's go right back to my Twitter analogy earlier. So we just came back this like week of, actually I can use an exact example for this. I'm sorry. I'm making this like a really long discussion, but whatever. Right. we just came through this week of, it was like the week of trans visibility, I think is what it was. So there was this big issue in Toronto where, there was a person who was speaking at the Toronto Public Library a week or so ago that was one of these trans exclusionary radical feminist types. And the trans community got right up in arms in Toronto about the fact that the library, which is this, you know, supposed to be pretty neutral public institution, was giving time and giving us a space to this person that they consider bigoted, right? And there was a protest and all this kind of stuff. And a lot of people I know that are from either from that community or from the music world were all involved in the protests and in the, you know, in talking about it on Twitter. And they were getting threats from all over the place sent to them because they were on scene on the news talking about it. And it was like this whole thing. And they're all for like the whole month tweeting up a storm about this, right? Like talking about it nonstop, because for them it's really like super important stuff. It's happening, you know, they're getting tangible threats out of being involved in this. It's about their, like, you know, rights issues that directly affect them, all that stuff, right? So I'm looking at all that going like wow, okay, there's some really powerful shit that's happening in these people's lives right now. And but I'm like, well, what do I do with that, right? I could sit there and like retweet their stuff all day and or respond and just be like, yeah, right? But outside of just injecting myself into it or projecting to the world that I'm an ally, right? Like I don't exactly know what value I'm adding there. So that's one of those things where I'm like, I should probably, you know, observe this and learn from it, but I don't know. I don't know what I add to everything by like somehow making this a me thing. And I guess that was kind of like where I was sort of coming at with that. But yeah, I don't know. It's a mixed analogy, John. I'm full of fucking cold medicine right now. Jesus Christ.
Well, there we have. That's the final word from Adam. We've got one more letter. This is no name. So you're always talking about the screaming female. You won't shut up about them. I went to see them. I snuck in and didn't pay. I felt so bad I almost did go back and pay. You are right. They were so cool, and they just kept going on and playing. They are what modern rock should be, not Foo Fighters. Why are all remaining famous rock bands bland while rap and soul are still interesting? And that's an unsigned email. And I don't know if I have an answer to that. I would say that hip-hop traditionally has been in a state of evolution. If we look at the age of hip-hop compared to the state of rock, a hip-hop, you could say, started in like 1974, I guess, roughly. So you could say that hip-hop is now, what, almost 50 years old, right? Or 40 years old? 45 years old. Or 45 years old. And so if we say rock started in 1955, that brings us to 2000.
To me, it was 95, John.
Yeah. If we assume that most genres have a certain lifespan, and I think you could make the argument that rock, at least in the traditional classic rock sense, has kind of met its limit, just like I would argue big band did, and even jazz did, kind of met the, or even blues, met the edge of what it can do. Now, I wouldn't apply that to punk. Then I guess hip hop is in about the year 2000 or so. So they've got another, you know, 10 years left to keep evolving. Although I don't really know if rock really evolved in 2000. I think by the time 2000 came along, rock was getting kind of retro with the Hives and the Vines and all those guys. So I mean, honestly, maybe hip hop is just more able to adapt because of the nature of what it is. And also maybe because hip hop is more able to adapt because it really doesn't have that many rules. The only rules are it's some person rhyming and they don't always rhyme. That's hip hop. You know, and whereas rock is kind of more, you know, guitar and drums and, you know, 3.5 minute songs or, you know, at least in that general construct, whereas hip hop can be anything. So I guess that's why I don't have a solid answer.
Well,
you know? I think
don't you?
Very interesting.
I mean, rock and roll reached its pinnacle when Korn did that EDM metal album. I think, right?
Yeah,
but that was the full evolution of rock and roll. That was officially the edge.
We should have just nuked the world at that point. I mean, where else can the human condition go from there? You know what I mean? It's like,
we already reached our peak. But no, I was gonna say the only person who can really answer this question for us is famous talking head Dave Grohl, I believe. So Dave, we should ask him next time. He's a talking head. You know, he's like a famous talking head. So we should have him on the podcast.
I think we should. So I can ask him, why did you stand Buzz Osborne up when they were recording the bass?
I would really like to hear about his time in DC hardcore band Scream.
Yeah, if he hasn't milked that enough for well, anyways. Tom, do you think
I know you got a beef with him. I don't. I think he's fine.
The thing with Dan Grohl, see, half people say Dave Grohl truly is a nice person, and it's good that he's famous because
I think I'm on that
he's
team.
A good guy. And the other half say he's a big phony, and the reason he got to where he is because he's very selective with the truth and is a phony baloney kind of guy. Adam White, what's your stance on Dave Grohl?
I think
the sex workers' rights.
Okay, here we go. So my beef with Dave Grohl is really more a beef, I think, with people who are casting documentaries not being very creative.
But that's the
also
other
thing, Ian MacKay, Henry Rollins. I mean, there's a handful of them.
Maybe Dave Grohl's being cool. Like, maybe no matter who asks Dave Grohl, he says, okay, I'll do it. Because if he said no all the time, people are like, Dave Grohl's a dick. He never does anything that's not directly benefiting him. So then when he does every documentary, people are like, why is Dave Grohl forcing himself in every documentary? Maybe people are asking him. I mean, I don't think Dave Grohl's going around asking him in people's documentaries. Is he?
He's got those Nirvana royalties so he can play drums for like Blast. You know, it works out. It all works out. It all evens out.
I'm willing to believe that Dave Grohl is ultimately just trying to have fun and not thinking too hard about things. And
I agree. And drinking beer and
he just wants to be, to be in a rock and roll band and have long hair. And that's all he wants. And then people are like, hey, we're making a documentary about, I don't know, the Minutemen,
the Bad Brains.
You know, do you want to be in that? He's gonna go, cool, all right, and he'll show up, and I'll give him a beer, and he has fun, and then he does all these things, and he doesn't realize that collectively it makes us all hate him. But not me.
I think he's America's sweetheart.
So Adam thinks Dave Grohl is the oblivious idiot.
Yes,
and Tom thinks Dave Grohl is Mr.
He's just
Rogers,
a big kid who's having fun playing rock and roll. That's it. Helps his buddies out.
And I'd say he's Sammy Hagar Pardue. Anyways, you can always use
that. I mean, is there a higher compliment than calling somebody Sammy Hagar?
Yeah, I was asking. Like,
I mean, he's the Roger Moore of Van Halen. I love him.
You can always use that podcast at punknews.org. listen, let's play. I'll play a song real quick. So anyways, Mean Jeans. We all love Mean Jeans. A lot of people don't know that Andrew Bassett of the Mean Jeans has got a spinoff project called The Hound of Love. And his first album was very good.
John, I'm going to cut you off, dude.
Oh yeah,
you played a Hounds of Love song. Was your last song you played on the?
Oh, I did.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, okay, well then, all right. So, anyways,
editing this episode.
I'm leaving that in.
I'm gonna play a song, and we talked about this band. This is if you told me this was the greatest band in the entire world, I wouldn't necessarily disagree. This is Rudimentary P&I. We're doing Choice of Evils, maybe my favorite Rudimentary P&I song. The only lyrics to the song: there is no right or wrong. There is no right or wrong. There is no. The right or wrong, so help the weak and fight the strong. Rudimentary P&I off Archaic. No, I'm sorry, off not Archaic, off the one with all the faces on the cover. What are their albums? They're all basically the same, but they're all awesome.
Saint Anger, it's also Saint Anger album.
Screw you, go.
No right.
This is going swimmingly, fellas.
Oh boy! All right, we're back. John, we are mostly my fault. 35 minutes into this thing, and we haven't really talked about any of the news. So which one are we picking first?
I was going to talk about the fader, but who cares anymore? I mean, what do we have to say about the fader? Let's talk about the Spits. Let's talk about fun stuff this week. How about that? Let's talk about mostly fun stuff. The Spits. They're putting out a live cassette to help fund their new album. The Spits actually have been doing for the past 3 years. The Spits have been saying we're going to put out a live cassette, and I know this because I interviewed them 3 years ago. And they're like, we're going on tour in 6 weeks, and we're going to put out a live cassette. Well, 3 years later, it's coming out, but technically, it's not even out yet because it's a pre-order. Anyways, they're putting out
Narmer Records. Narmer Records, John, is this your chance?
Well, not if they want any money, and I think I'd even put out make some money. The cassette is called Live Until You Die or Live Until You Die. I think it's a double entendre, if you will. It's self-released and it's funding their new album. So the cool thing is we got a new Spits album coming along the way, and we've got a Spits live album coming out on cassette. Two questions. A, how much money can you really make off a live cassette that's selling at $10 each? I think not that much. B, isn't it just wonderful how the Spits – like the persona of the Spits is that they're a bunch of like goofball mess-ups that – like can't really do anything right except for when they do manage to rock out that it freaking rule. That's the persona, but it's also the reality. You know, the Spits really are like maniacs, and so I'm excited. But here's the question, I guess, aside from those two questions, is the Spit every Spits record is pretty much the same and they all rule, but is that enough, or should we demand more from the Spits?
The Spits have the. I was going to say the Ramones problem, but it's not really a problem, I guess. It's like the Spits have that Ramones quality where they have a sound that is great. And, you know, as long as you have other music that is in your diet that you keep coming back to, you could put that out 12 times. And me personally, I'm not going to complain about it. I think that's different than a band, say, like, let's say like Pennywise that gets accused of the same thing. But I don't think that what Pennywise does is all that great in the first place. But like, I was never one of those people that had a problem with, say, you know, the Ramones having, you know, umpteen songs and records that all sound the same. I'm like, that's fine. I like that band's sound. So I like what they do. I like their whole aesthetic. Right. So it just works. And the Spits are that kind of band for me. So whenever like Spits 28 comes out, I'm in.
And hopefully it'll be self-titled like all the others, so you can't remember which came which, and makes it a virtual nightmare to collect.
Yeah, that is just a pain, eh? Jesus Christ! I was you know that really came back to bite me in the ass, and then I just flaked the fuck out. Was
the Bronx?
No. The Bronx did that too, but the so we as in Punk News published this. Top records of the 2000s thing.
Yep.
Which is to say the 12 or 14 people that contributed to it each gave their list of like top 100 records from that decade. And I didn't because I legitimately tried and I just could not get it together in a way that satisfied me. But one of the things that was driving me fucking nuts about it was mine was full of Spits records, and they were all like Spits bracket 2004, Spits bracket 2006, Spits bracket 2008. And I'm like, is Spits 2004 better than, you know, this record by the Bronx or that record by the, and I'm just looking at all this like alphabet soup of.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, none of them would have made it in the top 100 anyway, because they would have got edged out by such great albums as Eminem and God knows what other garbage.
Yeah, the driving.
Yeah. And exactly. Then the futility of that really just made me just throw up my hands and go like, none of this matters. And then I left. So.
Actually, along those lines, we got a freeform episode today. You know, end of year is coming up at Punk News. My favorite article every year at Punk News is your top 20 records of the year list. I got to say, boys, I don't know about you, but for me, I usually have like two or three records that are just fighting to the end for spot one, two, and three, just like fighting each other, you know, to the last second that I submit my list. This year, I got to say, a lot of great records came out this year. but I don't have any one, two, like I don't have any like few records that I'm like, oh, it's got to be these three. Like for me, my top 20 are all kind of like I don't have any rockets to the top of the chart this year. Do you guys?
Yeah, my top 10 are pretty fluid.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say. Depending on the day.
I feel like this was.
I got an idea what's probably going to end up. I probably have it down to three or four or five of there for that top spot, but we'll see how it falls out.
There's not one album this year that is just screaming for that top spot for me, and I don't know if that's because this year was weak, or if it's just because everything was fine. You know, like,
you know, I don't think it was strong. I think it was not, there wasn't a lot of really, truly amazing albums, but I wouldn't say it was weak in overall quantity. Like my list that I'm kind of winnowing off of is, there's going to be at least probably five albums that I think are worthy that aren't going to end up on my top 20, you know?
Yeah.
And that's like, me only having listened to a narrow, I only am able to really listen to a narrow scope. You know, it's not like I can listen to everything that comes out. So,
well, like I'm looking at my.
But yeah, none of them are like, I'm just at the age where even my favorite records of the year, I look back at the list and go, man, I really don't listen to that very much anymore.
Well, my list of like 2019 LPs that I have sitting here on iTunes right now is like maybe 36, 35 records long, right? So like, I could go and take a. I can cull 20 out of that for the sake of putting this article together, but it's not obvious to me what that 20 is. So, yeah, it's gonna be a weird one. This is gonna be the year where everyone puts out sort of a meandering list, and the only commonality behind them is like the stupidest record, and that ends up being the punk news album of the year. Because
yeah, the consensus could be very tricky, especially now among our writers. We have so many niche writers, you know, and this is coming from one of the niche writers who loves the, you know, classic punk thrash stuff. But you know, there's a guy who loves folk punk. There's all these emo kids, you know, there's lots of different, I don't know what there's a Menzinger's album. There's a few things like that that'll probably do pretty well. Like traditionally have done well, but yeah, I don't know what the top spot's going to be. It's probably not going to be on my list though. I mean, it's not going to be Bad Religion, right? That was very mediocre.
It's going to be, and I say this without
Wagon or something. I mean, maybe
probably something like that.
I was going to say, without any implication of negativity. It's going to be like a Jeff Rosenstock record that everyone had as like a record number.
Is that
six.
The one that came out like January 1st?
Well, yeah, that live one that came out too, but like it's going to be something like that. That it was like. Ugh. You know, that a bunch of people liked more because they liked the artist than because that album in particular was spectacular. I'm just using Rosenstock as a cipher here. I'm not actually saying him in particular, but it's going to be something that just like, you know, perfunctorily ends up on everyone's lists and then it's going to somehow take a top spot.
That's going to be the damn Lagwagon album, man. Now I'm thinking about it. I mean, that's the one album that everybody's going to have on their list, except for me.
And me.
That seemed to be a universally loved album. I can't get into that band. I don't hate them or anything. I can never get into them too much. But like, yeah, the ones you'd anticipate, I think were the bands you might anticipate. The albums were just not that great.
Speaking of anticipated things, Black Flag is going on tour in 2020.
Oh, yes, we're wet with anticipation over
and,
here.
And they've got a lot of USA tour dates and a lot of South American tour dates. Here's the thing is, Black Flag actually just completed a USA tour like last month or whatever. And unlike the past, like the previous Black Flag tours where there's all this hubbub and arguing and this and that, like no one even gave a shit. You know, like I mean, as listeners probably know, Black Flag 2020 is Greg Ginn, Mike V, and two dudes. I don't even remember the other two. Like two dudes you'd even heard of, you know. I mean, like, is the Black Flag War over? Has Ginn destroyed his legacy? And is there anything left to talk about with regards to Black Flag? Or is Black Flag now just another, you know, what's the word about? Dickies, or even less than a Dickies. You know, maybe a Vibrators or a Inverize, something like that.
It might be worse. Because there's no contention about, you know, the Dickies, or like if you're one of those bands, you don't have a big group of people that actively dislike you or that actively hoping that you fail.
I think the Dickies might have been a bad example for that.
They got in trouble, didn't they? But like, I don't know, like, say, take, like, I don't know, what's that, what's the face paint band? The Droogs there.
The Addicts,
right?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, they've been around, you know, for 40 fucking years, something probably, yeah, 40 years. Right? You know,
like 80-ish, yeah.
They'll come to town and people will turn out and go see them. But on the other hand, the people that turn out and go see them are, you know, this certain slice of the punk community that, you know, probably isn't going to show up when XYZ local band is playing.
Oh,
you know, they're there because they remember that band from years ago. And, you know, they're going to have some nostalgic fun by going to a concert. But like, at least the Addicts can do that and like not be reviled by a certain slice of the scene. Like the worst the Addicts probably have to deal with is indifference. And,
but you know, here's the thing with the Addicts, Adam. The Addicts have had the same five guys for 30 years. I don't know if they've never had a lineup change, but it's been the same guys. It has an authenticity that Black Flag can't claim.
Yeah, I keep picking the wrong examples here. I don't know.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, finish. I got some thoughts on this too, but I'll try not to interrupt anymore.
No.
I'm trying to point out how bad every example you pick is, Adam.
I'm full of Sudafed or whatever the fuck. Yeah. So I don't even know where he's going with this.
I get what you're saying there. Why is there so much anger towards this band when they do it and not?
Well, no. I mean, I get why there's anger towards them. I'm just saying that like being some nostalgia act that no one gives a shit about is one thing, but being a nostalgia act that either no one gives a shit about or people hate you is probably a worse thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking, John was thinking about Rudimentary Peni today. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about Black Flag because this story caught my eye, of course. And Black Flag is truly, you know, in so many ways, they parallel the Misfits. Because, you know, but right now Black Flag is in the stage of Misfits where, remember, the Misfits got together with Michael Graves and people were sort of excited about it. And they were a pretty good live band at that time. But then Graves left and Jerry Only took over. But we're not even, Black Flag's not even to that point. Black Flag is the point where
we're out of time, Tom.
Mark DeRamon left. So they got Robo back, but then they got a no-name drummer. And then eventually Dez left and they got a no-name guitar player. So it was literally just Jerry Only, like his son playing guitar and some no-name drummer. That's where Black Flag is now. They have nothing. You know what I mean? They don't have any of the credibility they had when, who came back, when,
Ron,
what's his name?
Ron
back and sang for him.
Ron Reyes.
When Ron Reyes came back and sang for him. Yeah, they're like stage 6.0 where they have nothing. They're just dragging the name through the mud. I mean, if it wasn't for that famous looking four bars logo, they would have nothing.
That's harsh, John, but
is anybody like the war's over? A Flag has clearly won, you know. And
yeah, but Flag ain't doing anything either, John.
What's that?
They're not doing anything either, though.
Well, I know they won. They kept playing shows after Black Flag, and then once it got kind of to be sort of a common thing, they kind of stopped doing it, which was smart. And they come back.
Yeah, they don't want to devalue themselves.
Yeah. You know, like they do maybe one or two shows a year or something, which I think
Black Flag is definitely devaluing themselves by playing so much, by playing these dinky clubs.
Well, yeah. I mean, like what's the point? You know? Oh, like what's the point?
Got to make a living, dude.
You think? I guess he's making some money doing it, right? So
don't you think he'd make more money remastering the Black Flag and Husker Du albums and actually making decent sounding new vinyl records?
You know, maybe not, because I mean, nobody buys music anymore, you know, but
yeah, but punks do, dude.
Yeah, it's true.
Older punks.
I mean, as Henry Rollins has explained, there are, very good Black Flag outtakes. And Henry Rollins actually did a DJ set about 10 years ago where he played a bunch of them. And he said, I can't put these up because I'll get sued. But so I'll just play them at this show for fun. It was like a fundraiser. There's alternate version. There's a version of Henry doing Louie Louie. There's alternate versions. There's even the Licorice Pizza 7-inch, which Greg can make bonus tracks out of. You know, he just, who knows, man? He's a weird guy. So, but I mean, no one has done more to damage Greg Ginn's legacy than Greg Ginn. And I would say the war is over. Greg Ginn's Black Flag has been defeated. I mean, he might not see that from his perspective, but like, no one cares anymore. And
it might be defeated, John, but he's literally like that, like the Japanese soldier who got the order to never surrender that they found in like the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
Who just kept like holding his post.
Well put, Thomas.
Listen, if they came to play a tiny dive near me, I would still go, but I'm not going to drive anywhere to go see them.
Yeah, yeah. Let's do one more quick story. We'll play a song. We'll come back. We'll do maybe two quick stories, and then maybe we'll wrap it up. How's that sound?
That's fine. Do it.
Okay. So anyways, Danzig, Veronica was supposed to come out as a DVD on October 31st. And like all Danzig projects like the past 20 years, the deadline came and went and we didn't hear anything. And in the Danzig Facebook group, people were like, Glenn just needs time to perfect it. He just needs time. You know, anyways, they're doing a Philadelphia.
Just like that Elvis, just like that Elvis covers up.
Right? Yeah, he needs 6 years to perfect his six Elvis covers. Anyways, the Danzig movie is being shown in Philadelphia. And boys, I am going. And by all accounts, the movie is atrocious. I have a feeling that it's bad, but it's not as bad as people are saying it is. They're just kind of – I mean, I'm sure it's not good.
I hope you're wrong. I hope it's every bit as bad.
What do I do? What do I do if I go and it's like really bad?
What it's going to be, dude. You might as well prepare yourself right now.
What if I go and it's like really bad but hilarious? Or what if I go and it's just, you know, basically a sci-fi film from like the 1998? You know, just like a forgettable –
Oh, I don't think it's going to be that. I don't think it's going to be that. I think it's going to be unforgettable, but not in a good way.
John, this is where your status as a teetotaler is really working against you, because you could be high as balls and go to this thing and it could be horrible, but then it would be sort of amusing for that reason. But I don't know.
I don't think Adam can have any concept of how pitiful the hardcore Danzig fans are, John. I mean, he could literally take a dump on stage and it would be the greatest thing ever.
Well, isn't that Gigi Allen's whole thing?
Well, I guess. But I mean, Dan, you know, his diehard fans are just, they're maniacs. Idiots.
What it is honestly that they insult him by like saying every single thing he does is amazing, because Danzig's proven himself time and time again. So if he never puts out anything good ever again, it kind of doesn't matter, because he's already put out at least 12 amazing albums, right? And so it's like,
I'd have to count, I don't know if it's that many, but
say 8 to 10 or 12, whatever.
All right,
a lot more than most people.
More than Greg
Ginn, you know what I mean?
Ooh, that'd be a good, yeah, probably.
So anyway, the point being is by always saying everything's the greatest ever, what you're actually saying is, in the back of my mind, I think this new thing might not be that good, so I'm scared to actually put it to the test, so I'm not going to test it. It's like that video. If you guys seen that video where it's Steven Seagal in Japan from like 2012, and I'm not making fun of anybody, but Steven Seagal is not in the shape that he used to be in. And so he's like doing a demonstration. So all these like expert like kung fu guys or whatever, they're like doing a training with him. And so like they go to punch, but they like miss on purpose. And then he like kind of like just turns his arm and the kung fu guys like flip over like three times. And it's clear that they're like knocking themselves out just so they don't dishonor Steven Seagal. You know what I'm saying?
Here's a synopsis for you hardcore Danzig people. Saying that 666, Danzig 666, Satan's Child is a perfect value, a perfect album, devalues Lucifuge. Stop doing it.
Yeah.
No? No?
I agree with that. But however, to play my own devil's advocate, which Danzig would approve the use of that term. Boy. Is, listen, at least he's trying. I mean, at least he's trying to do interesting things. Like the Elvis thing is probably going to be pretty bad, but at least he's trying, you know?
I mean, I guess I'll settle for interesting, but I'd rather have good. But yeah, interesting is something.
I hear you, but on the other hand, he could be Megadeth. where he just cranks out the same album every year, and it just gets progressively worse and more boring. You know,
oh, should go on the cruise, the Megadeth cruise. We go see the Mega cruise, hang out with Danzig on the big boat.
At least Danzig is doing the true punk rock thing, and he's doing what he wants to do without concept of commercial appeal. And certainly without concept of what the fans want, you know.
He's doing the punk rock thing, surrounding himself by yes men who tell him everything, every shitty thing he does is great.
Well, that's true too. But at least he's trying to do daring things, and there's worse things as an artist than to try to do daring things. At least he's trying, and I mean, he's put out so much amazing art. I don't think he can ever be devalued. You know, it'd be nice if he put out another Danzig 3 or 4 or 1 or 2. But it's not going to happen. But he's already put out, you know, 8 to 12 amazing albums. And so, you know, that's the nature of art. You know, sometimes
the problem with a guy like Danzig, supremely talented guy, no question about it, but also a guy with an ego. And he has a hard time, I think, admitting that he's better when he has good people around him. He wants to be everything himself. You know, he wants credit for everything. But the fact of the matter is, the reason those early Danzig records were so good is because his band was so good.
Honestly, Tom, that is incredibly insightful, and I agree with that 100%. And that's also the Greg Ginn problem, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah,
you're right, because his collaborators now, I mean, now there's no kind of a partnership. It's basically he does, you know, 75% of it. At least when Reyes was there, there was probably a little bit of that. And that's probably why he had to get rid of Ron Reyes, honestly. Didn't want to share that power, you know?
Well, let's play a song and kick out a couple of quick stories and then wrap this bad
boy. We managed to talk about Danzig, so that's important.
Play a tune.
Whose turn is it?
You can do
Adam, play a tune.
Oh, shit. All right.
I'm totally unprepared. I've really sucked at picking out songs lately, so.
Okay. I'll stick to.
Do a Motley Crue song, dude. Celebrate the Motley Crue reunion. Do Shout at the Devil live with Vince Neil. Caterwauling.
No. Okay, so.
Canadians.
Speaking of Motley Crue, here's a band from Halifax, Nova Scotia. So I think this is a home recording project from a guy whose name is Luke Mumford, who's played in a bunch of Halifax area hardcore bands like Negative Rage and Genetic Angry. So he has a band called the Mark Vodka Group. That plays this just kind of like really fun 77 inspired punk stuff, but I'm not convinced it's a real band. I think it's just something he's just kind of thrown together at home and putting out. And they have a new record that is out. It is called A New Record. And one of the songs on A New Record that I think is fun and has a little bit of a Buzzcocks callback in one of the verses is called Everybody's Punk Now. So I'm going to play that song. So this is Everybody's Punk Now by the Mark Vodka Group.
The Mark Vodka Group doing Everybody's Punk Now. We're going to blast through just a couple of things. Adam and Tom aren't going to want to talk about this, but I'm going to talk about this quickly anyway. Gwen Stefani, she's re-releasing her first solo album. The album is called Love Angel Music Baby and was recorded during a hiatus of No Doubt. No Doubt didn't get back together after Gwen released her first and second solo album, but I think this first solo album is kind of what was the division between Gwen and No Doubt. And I feel as though No Doubt never really fully recovered from that, and I think the No Doubt era is over. The new release of Love Angel Music Baby, it's got the same track listing as the original release. It's just remastered sound, but I mean, I don't know what you need to do with a 2004 record to remaster it. It was recorded in 2004, the modern era. It sounds fine. It sounds great. The point being is I love this record. It's a pop record, but I think it's probably the best pop record in pop that is like Madonna-style music. I think it's a fantastic record. And I am frustrated when people say, why are you talking about Gwen Stefani? This is in popnews.org. Like, well, she was in No Doubt, which, I mean, you know, they're not rudimentary peni, but they're as punk as, say, Green Day or whatever. Anyways, I'm excited for this. Well, I'm not excited for this. I'm probably not going to get this. But this is a great record. Love Angel Music Baby is probably one of the best pop records ever, I think. And Gwen's extremely talented, and I think she's cool.
John, this shit is bananas.
Yeah, I couldn't care less.
Second to last story, the OCs, they are putting out a box set. It is 12, count them, 12 8-track cartridges.
Now, this is something we can all get behind.
It runs $420, and the kicker is that the 8-tracks aren't even new 8-tracks. Apparently, there are very few 8-track pressing plants anymore. I think there's actually one guy that actually does make them still, but you got to like contact him like directly. But anyway, so what they did is they took other
pigeon.
They took other 8-track tapes, wiped them, and then redubbed OC songs over used 8-tracks. So what you're getting is a box set of reconditioned 8-tracks for $420. There's 100 of them only, and I don't know if they're sold out by now, but they put out a label that is famous for putting out like obscure formats. They've put out music on floppy disks, on Nintendo cartridges, and other things like that, which is amusing. You guys know me. I love weird and wacky ideas, but I do wonder, is this too much? You know, for $420 for I would not be surprised if none of these were ever listened to ever. You know, it's
crazy money, dude. Crazy money.
So do you guys think this is fun wackiness or is this stupid?
It's not for me.
It is visually cool. Like the little carrying case that they have it in, and
I can't imagine they sell these.
It's, you know what, if you're a weird psych rock band with a giant catalog, you have at least enough of whatever you call your version of deadheads that are out there that would happily pay $420 to get like a weird shit artifact for it from you. So I don't know. Like I'm looking at the pictures of this, and I don't care about the OCs, and I certainly don't want 8-tracks. But this is so fun looking. It looks so fun. So
yeah. It's 1 week from today, Adam. After you spend the next week thinking about this, by this time next week, you'd be like, man, I think I'm going to get into 8-tracks because it'll fester in the back of your mind. You know, like true. When you go to a record store and you're like, I should buy this. And then you leave and you don't. And you're at home like, oh, I should have bought that record. I got to go back and get
that's
that
true.
Record.
That's true.
That's what's going to happen with these 8-tracks.
There's something about a stack of multicolored 8-track tapes that is bringing my brain back to like just seeing like a stack of like Atari cartridges or something like that. You know, as a kid, and I don't know, like just like the pictures of this are making the sentimental part of my brain happy. I would not pay for it, but it is, you know, I'll review it if they want to send it to me.
If they want to send you a review copy, you will borrow your uncle's 1977 Chrysler and tool. around for a week listening to those things.
The
I mean, can you even go on Amazon and buy them? I mean, can you buy a freaking 8-track player?
I'm sure you can get one off eBay. I mean,
plus everyone's different, right? Because I mean, they're going to be like Willie Nelson's greatest hits, except for it's going to have OCs. I don't know the OCs at all.
They're like in this like San Francisco psych rock world pretty big. Like the I don't think it is certainly not a gamble for them to put this together and to try to sell it for that price. like I think that like people will buy it. That is not a problem. But it is.
It's like peak hipster though.
Yeah, it's. I don't know. It's just.
I don't think it's hipster. I think it's wet. Like hipsters would like get some. No, I don't even.
No,
like,
this is hipster, John. This is hipster, man.
I don't even think like hipsters really exist anymore. I think that's kind of diffused into some other thing, you know. But like the idea of hipster is like, oh, I listen to records or I listen to tapes because it's a superior sound listening, you know, experience. I don't think anybody's getting this because 8-tracks are the superior anything. I think people are getting this because it's a wacky, dumb idea, you know.
But it's too expensive for a joke, at least for me.
Well, I think it's more San Francisco freak than it is hipster, if you will. You know?
All right. We're splitting hairs, but still, man, that's a lot of cash.
Yeah.
It's a lot of cash. It is.
I mean, it's, again, I would have a hard time justifying spending that much on even bands that I really like. So I'm stretching to try to see the upside on this. But. I'm just saying, I'm looking at the pictures, and the pictures are not making me angry. The pictures are making me happy.
1 week from today, Adam's going to be like, dudes, I bought the freaking 8-track box set.
Tom, John, can I borrow $210 from each of you? Yeah.
Be like, I'll tell you what, I'll burn it for you on CD. I'll burn it for you on CD.
Well, listen, you can reach at podcast@punknews.org. It's always a pleasure. It's always a pleasure.
We had our rough moments today, no question. But overall, you know, we did our good work, I think.
We won God's work, for sure.
Exactly.
I think my esophagus is going to fall out of my neck.